Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other entertaining and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Hi, I'm Alan Saunders. This year marks the 25th birthday of Al-Qaeda and its particular brand of Islamist ideology and philosophy. So today on the Philosopher's Zone, we're exploring the life and times of a man who greatly influenced Al-Qaeda and the modern Islamist movement, the Egyptian thinker Sayyid Qutb. Qutb's writing covered all sorts of territory: opposition to servitude to other men, disdain for materialism, un-Islamic Muslim governments, and a marked dislike for most things Western. He even had something to say about the obsession Americans had with their lawns. No doubt he would have said the same about Australia if he'd ever been here. Qutb spent many years in jail during the 50s and 60s. But before his execution by the Egyptian government, he was the leading intellectual of the infamous Muslim Brotherhood. In more recent years, what has kept Sayyid Qutb's ideas alive has been the impression that they've made on the leaders of Al-Qaeda, like Dr. Abdullah Azim and the second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Here's Ayman al-Zawahiri speaking a couple of years ago.
The English language is the language of the Muslims' enemies who have occupied their lands, forcibly implanted Israel in their midst, looted their resources, tortured, deported, and killed them, and aided, supported, and enforced the corrupt tyrant regimes which are sucking our blood and replacing our divine shariat with man-made laws.
So this week I'm talking to John Calvert, Associate Professor of History at Creighton University in Nebraska in the US, and one of the few Westerners to have translated one of Qutb's books.
Sayyid Qutb is perhaps the most influential Islamist ideologue in the second half of the 20th century, and he remains very, very important today. So in that respect, his ideas are important and substantial.
He wrote a number of books. One which is frequently quoted is Milestones, but he also wrote a 30-volume work called In the Shade of the Quran, and he wrote it while in jail. Is that his substantial contribution?
Fi Zilal al-Quran, or In the Shade of the Quran, is Sayyid Qutb's magnum opus. He actually began the work prior to his imprisonment in the early 1950s, but it was really while he was in prison that he gave his work, this Quranic exegesis, the edge, you know, that's made it so famous today.
Paul Berman, the author of Terror and Liberalism, and one of probably a fairly small number of Westerners to have read at least some of the volumes of In the Shade of the Quran that have been translated into English, gives this long and quite remarkable assessment of the work. He says it's a vast and elegantly constructed architecture of thought and imagination, a work of true profundity, vividly written, wise, broad, indignant, sometimes demented, bristly with hatred, medieval, modern, tolerant, intolerant, cruel, urgent, cranky, tranquil, grave, poetic, learned, analytic, moving in some passages, a work large enough to create its own shade. Now, I gather that you're not quite that enamoured of In the Shade of the Quran, but how important do you think this prison writing was for Islamist thought over the past half century?
Well, I think most of those terms do in fact apply. It is a magisterial work. It really is quite remarkable. The man truly was prolific, and his prose style is elegant and stylish. That being said, I think the content of In the Shade of the Quran can be reduced to three basic ideas, the first of which is that sovereignty belongs to God alone. The term that Qutb uses is al-hakamiyya, which we might translate as sovereignty. He believed that sovereignty had been usurped by human beings, by rulers like Gamal Abdel Nasser, who legislated in God's place. And the legislation put out by people like Gamal Abdel Nasser was necessarily imperfect. And that brings us to the second major idea in Qutb's work, and that is that there is no true Islamic society in the world, according to Sayyid Qutb. And that's because there is no Islamic society that fully recognizes God's sovereignty. Muslim societies, Muslim governments throughout Africa and Asia are whoring after the false idols of secularism and materialism. They ignore the totality of God's way. And as a result, there is much injustice and iniquity in the world. Qutb uses the term jahiliya to refer to the state of affairs. Jahiliya originally referred to the period of ignorance in the Arabian Peninsula prior to the advent of the Quran, but Sayyid Qutb excises the term from its temporal context and applies it to the condition of the world in his own time. People are generally ignorant of God's will.
Well, let's look at the man himself and how he came to value the Quran as the shade, as the comfort of his life. Where does he come from? What's his background?
Well, Sayyid Qutb was born in a small little village called Musha in Upper Egypt in 1906. And it was a very traditional upbringing. He went to the local Quran school. He became a hafiz, or a memorizer of the Quran, at the age of 10. And then in his teens, he made his way to Cairo to further his education. He enrolled at the Dar el-Ulum, the teacher's training college. His life's ambition, or his ambition to that point, was to become an effendi, a middle-class civil servant. He wanted to be actually a school teacher.
Qutb shifted from a secular path to a stridently Islamist one, but for a time it looked as though he might even be the education minister after the free officers took over government in Egypt in 1952, led by Gamal Abdel Nasser. I mean, he wasn't an obvious enemy of Nasser to begin with, was he?
No, that's quite right. Qutb first drifted to Islamism in the late 1940s. His first Islamist work was a book called Social Justice in Islam. And his ideology at this particular point was very close to that of the Muslim Brotherhood, although he wouldn't join that organization until 1953. Like the Muslim Brothers, like Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Brotherhood, Qutb believed in gradualism. He believed that a true Islamic society will only come into being through the conversion of hearts and minds. He believed in influencing the powers that be rather than confronting them. Sayyid Qutb, like other Muslim Brothers, was very excited when Gamal Abdel Nasser and the free officers came to power. I think Sayyid Qutb, like the many Muslim Brothers, believed that Gamal Abdel Nasser would implement an Islamic state in Egypt. He would implement Islamic law. And I think the Muslim Brothers had reason for suspecting that might be the case, because Nasser and other free officers, many of them anyway, had been very close to the Muslim Brothers in pre-revolutionary time. Nasser had attended some of their meetings and so forth. But very quickly it became apparent that Nasser and the free officers were not going to implement Sharia law in Egypt, that the revolution was indeed a secular one. By that time, and here we are in 1954, Gamal Abdel Nasser had rid the political field of communists, of the parliamentary system. All potential contenders for power had been gotten rid of except the Muslim Brothers. And he used the excuse of an assassination attempt on him to proscribe the Muslim Brotherhood. And Sayyid Qutb was caught up in the dragnet, and that's how he ended up in prison. But prior to that, yes, Sayyid Qutb had been excited by Gamal Abdel Nasser and had worked very closely with the free officers.
One of the differences between Islam and Christianity, and to a large extent between Islam and Judaism as well, is that in Islam there isn't actually a priesthood, is there? There are some people who are more knowledgeable than others, but basically all believers are at an equal distance or proximity to God, which can give to Islam really quite a radical egalitarianism, can't it?
Well, I think that's quite right. That being said, there is a class of religious specialists in Islam, the ulama. They're sort of like rabbis in the Jewish tradition. They're teachers, they're religious guides. It's interesting that many Islamists, could have included, believed, and I think with reason, that the ulama, the clerical class, had been co-opted by the political establishment, that they weren't looking after the interests of the people. They allowed social injustice to sort of, you know, creep into their societies and so forth.
Qutb was a man of faith, but he was presumably also a man of reason. What did he take to be the role of reason in religious discourse?
Well, unlike many Muslim reformers, unlike Muhammad Abdu, the Egyptian reformer of the late 19th century, he did not believe that reason and revelation were equal, that they complemented one another. Qutb really believed that reason reached its limits when confronted with questions of moral judgment. He believed that philosophical equations rooted in reason were dangerous. Number one, because they diminished the status of the Quran as first source, and number two, they legitimize the entry into Islam of secular Western culture. So he was very distrustful of the role of reason in discerning God's will. He was a fundamentalist in that sense.
This is a long debate in Islamic thought, isn't it? So I assume that he is turning his back here on a lot of very distinguished Islamic philosophers like Averroes or Ibn Sina and so on.
Quite right. He explicitly condemns those particular individuals and their modern equivalents, people like Abdu, but also Iqbal of Pakistan. All of these people have erred by assigning reason an extraordinary role in understanding the will of God for humankind.
So he's with Al-Ghazali. I mean, he basically thinks that, you know, if you've got the word of God, the literal word of God, there can only be a limited role for reason.
Yeah, the analogy with Al-Ghazali is not bad. As I said, say Qutb had a mystical temperament. I mean, this was sort of innate in him. He believed that truth was something that could be discerned, you know, through the spirit, essentially. So, yes, I think he criticizes medieval philosophers quite strongly.
The philosophers, Ibn Sina and Averroes, of whom Said Qutb disapproved, I suppose it would be reasonable to say that their basic position, like that of the great medieval Jewish philosopher Maimonides, was finding a way of uniting the thought of Aristotle, the rational thought of the Greeks, and what we might call the Semitic divine revelation. Would that be true?
Oh, I think that's right. And I think many of these philosophers emphasized the Greek philosophers, you know, at the expense of the Quran, the Semitic prophetic tradition. Many of them, of course, upheld the so-called double truth, you know, that revelation and reason point to a single truth expressed two ways. But I think ultimately this points to the utility of reason in discerning truth.
The Egyptian singer Kultum, whose career spanned much of the 20th century and who was a particular favourite of the Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser. And today on the Philosopher's Zone, we're talking about an Egyptian thinker, Said Qutb, with John Calvert from Creighton University in Nebraska. At the end of the 1950s, Qutb lived in the United States for about 18 months, having been sent there by the Egyptian government to observe teaching methods in American schools. His observations weren't limited to schooling, however, and Qutb didn't like what he saw. Take this, for example.
Everywhere there are smiles and everywhere there is fun, and on every corner hugs and kisses. But never does one see contentment on a person's face. There is no indication of satisfaction in anyone's heart. Life is comprised of constant worry, endless work, unending desire, the constant quenching of thirst, and the effort to be on time. Kutub also joined in with local church activities wherever he was in the United States, and he relates this story about a dance that followed a church service.
The dance hall convulsed to the tunes of the gramophone and was full of pounding feet and seductive legs. Arms circled waists, lips met lips, chests met chests, and the atmosphere was full of passion. The minister came down from his office and took a look around the place and encouraged those men and women still seated and not part of the circus to get up and participate. Then he advanced towards the gramophone to choose a song appropriate to the atmosphere, which would encourage those seated to get up on their feet. And the father chose. He chose the famous American song, "Baby, It's Cold Outside," which relates a conversation between a boy and a girl returning from their evening out. The boy took the girl back to his place and prevented her from leaving. She asked him to free her so that she could return home where her mother was waiting. Whenever she came up with an excuse, he would reply, "But baby, it's cold outside."
I really can't stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you'd
so
drop in.
Very nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my
ice.
My mother will start to
beautiful,
worry.
What's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really I'd better stay.
You know, Kutub, like many Egyptians, like many Arabs of the period, believed that the East was inherently spiritual and that the West was mired in materialism. Kutub articulated that view very clearly prior to his embarkation to the United States. I think once in the States, he saw what he wanted to see. You know, he viewed the country through the tinted spectacles of a man converted to a special vision of the world. But I can't believe that Kutub, you know, having spent well over a year in the United States, something like a year and a half, didn't have one positive experience, didn't have one sort of meaningful relationship. And I think he's basically cherry-picking. He's basically zoning in on those experiences that confirmed his preconception of America, writing about them, and sending those letters back home to Egypt, which were published in journals like Ar-Risala. And I think his basic message is that, listen, Egypt is in the process of secularizing, it's westernizing, the elite classes are pressing an alien culture upon us. I'm here in the United States, you know, at the epicenter of modern materialist civilization, and it's not a pretty picture. Don't go there. You know, I think that's basically his message in these letters home, in which he talks about life in the United States.
But it is quite bizarre, because he was staying at Greeley in Colorado. Greeley was a terribly respectable place. There was a ban on alcohol still in effect during his stay. He couldn't have found a quieter place to be, could he?
Well, that's right. I think, you know, Chicago Civic League elevated Greeley to status as one of the top all-American cities. I mean, it represented the best that America had to offer. But, you know, the thing is that even within the context of Greeley in the late 1940s, there were things that rubbed him the wrong way, things that are fundamental to American society, but which did not sit well with Kutub. You mentioned at the beginning of the program Kutub's preoccupation with lawn care. That is the case. I mean, he would wander the streets of Greeley summer evenings. He was astounded that so few people were on the streets to enjoy the bucolic landscape. And he was mystified that when Americans did appear outside, they would tend their gardens, they would mow their lawns, trim their hedges, and so forth. And for Qutb, this was symptomatic of America's preoccupation with the materialist aspect of life. You know, rather than engage with their neighbors and so forth, they basically barricaded themselves in their yards, tended their gardens.
But I'm sure if he, perhaps he did, but I'm sure if he spoke to a citizen of Greeley about this, the citizen of Greeley would say, well, this is engaging with our neighbours. We're doing our duty to make the neighbourhood look nice and tidy.
Well, he may have done so. He may have had such a conversation, but he didn't write about it.
In 2001, after September the 11th, there was some talk in the West of there being two forces conjoined in battle. There was Islamism, whose prophet was Said Qutb, and there was neoconservatism, whose prophet was the German philosopher, long resident in the United States, Leo Strauss. Now, I think Leo Strauss, though slightly strange, is a substantial philosophical presence. Is it worth comparing the two?
Well, I think it is. I think both Strauss and Qutb shared the notion that their respective societies were in tailspin, in moral decline. I think perhaps that's where the comparison ends. Strauss really wanted to create a mythology that would bring Americans back to their greatness, bring Westerners back to their greatness. Qutb, of course, sought to do the same thing, although I think he would be loath to use the term mythology to describe the ideology that he brought about. But both thinkers, I think, have that in common, the idea that the world is in crisis. People are whoring after the false idol of materialism. They're living these individual lives isolated from one another. I think if Qutb and Strauss had a conversation, they would find that they did have many ideas in common.
That's a wonderful might have been of human history. Just finally, here is a man who writes a book called In the Shade of the Quran, which looks at the way in which religion gives meaning to the life of the believer and the details of this meaning. How do we get from there to 3,000 people being incinerated in Manhattan in the year 2000. 3,000 people, some of whom, of course, are actually Muslims. How do we get there?
Well, first of all, I don't think Qutb would have approved of the September 11th attacks at all. This is one of the questions that came to my mind in the aftermath of the of those terror attacks. You know, what would Sayyid Qutb have thought about this? And he wouldn't have approved of them. I mean, he states explicitly that he was against the killing of innocents. He never advocated terror. In Milestones, he talks about using force against the powers that be in order to bring about a true Islamic society, but he's very vague as to how that order is to be toppled or brought down. That said, I think Qutb would have understood the symbolic meaning of those terror attacks. He would have understood that the Twin Towers, you know, represented the might of Western materialist civilization. The men of Al-Qaeda who engaged in that attack had read Sayyid Qutb. They were very much attracted to his idea of the modern Jahiliyyah. They approved of Sayyid Qutb's understanding of offensive jihad. They believed that that was the way to go. But they took his concepts and took them in a direction that he would not have approved of.
Dr. John Calvert is Associate Professor of History at Creighton University, Nebraska. He has written about and translated into English some of the writings of the Egyptian Islamist we've been talking about today, Sayyid Qutb. Thanks for listening to The Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. The show's producer is Kyla Slaven, and our sound engineer is Charlie McCune. To take us out, a little more of Johnny Mercer and Margaret Whiting with Baby, It's Cold Outside, which spent 19 weeks on the American charts in 1949.
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong
At
sorrow.
Least there will be plenty in play.
If you caught pneumonia and
I really
died,
can't
get
stay.
Over that old doubt. It's cold outside.
What I'd like to know about Pool is why I'd put my creative content there and not on MySpace.
With Pool, you can collaborate, publish your material, and remix or reuse what's already there.
Okay, so my old band Toxic Shock, we can put that up there.
Sure. With Pool, anyone can share their images, audio, video and text and connect with Radio National producers and listeners. Pool, a place where audiences become makers. Details at the Radio National website.